The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee, and I believe we're on slide 44, unless members have questions still on slide 43. So if the university, again, before you start, would just tell us who you are as you're going over the material, that would be great. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the CFO and treasurer at the University of Minnesota. We'll pick up today. Well, I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves quickly again.
Good afternoon. Lincoln Carlson. I'm the director of financial research at the university.
Julie Tonneson, associate vice president for budget and finance and budget director.
We'll pick up today, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on slide 45, which I'll introduce and then turn to my colleague Lincoln Paulson to take you through the details of this analysis. You may all recall that when President Kaler arrived, he began, of course, asking the university questions about our administrative costs. And we also then, of course, had a along the way this past fall, an article in the Wall Street Journal about administrative costs. Well, before that particular article even was a glimmer in the reporter's eyes, the university had embarked on a definition of our administrative costs and a benchmarking of this, because that was something that President Kaler had a desire to understand and the Board of Regents had a desire to understand. And we proceeded with a pretty extensive review. And what we wanted to do in this review was really develop a shared understanding inside the university and outside the university about a definition of administrative costs. That's a very complicated term. People are not always sure what they mean. Are you talking about administrators? Are you talking about administrative costs? How do you define it? Well, we decided we needed to define it for President Kaler because he wanted to promote a dialogue in the inside the university community about our administrative cost structure. He wanted to understand, because our HR system is creaky and old, what were the gaps in our ability to collect that information and report it. We wanted then to create a methodology in reporting this information that we could use over and over again in order to monitor it over time. And we just wanted our ability to understand better what our benchmark was in these particular categories. We shared this study, incidentally, and I know there'll probably be questions along the way about the Wall Street Journal article, because this does in part relate to that. And I will tell you that we did share this study with the Wall Street Journal reporter, but he chose not to use this data and used other data. And along the way here, we will share with you some of the flaws in the data that the Wall Street Journal reporter used and why we didn't use that data and decided to create our own benchmark and our own view of this particular area of cost at the institution. And with that, I'll turn to my colleague, Lincoln Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Briefly, we have been working on related issues around benchmarking cost administration for a while now. This is building, this study that we're going to take you through this afternoon builds on two previous studies. Earlier in the year, we presented to the Board of Regents a workforce analysis study in June, which really was a study to try to make better sense of our various employee groups and how those have changed over time. And as we've mentioned in previous testimony, we've also produced a what we call a fully allocated cost of mission study, and we took the regions through that in two steps, which is really a function code analysis, function analysis of our spend on all three of our missions. And we use both of those studies as building blocks for this cost definition benchmarking study that we're going to take you through today. Just a quick orientation, we're going to, before we dive into the weeds a little bit, this is our change in employee headcount over the past 10 years. And as you can see, our total employees, and this includes graduate assistants, really doesn't vary much year to year. 2.8% total headcount growth over that 11-year period, I apologize. So about 0.25% a year. Over the same time period, student headcounts went up 14%. Degrees granted went up 41%. Sponsored expenditures went up 44%. And we can talk within those bars and break that down a little bit for you, but we can talk more about that.
Mr. Carlson, Representative Winkler, where is he? There he is, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I did some quick math several days ago now, but you're finally getting to the slide, so I'm trying to take it sequentially. So the 2011 total employee count is 25,166. And then I went back to your slide number 5, student headcount. This is 2012, but I'm guessing 2012, 2011 are reasonably mm-hmm. comparable. And there's a total of 68,000 students, including the 6,500 non-degree seeking students. But 68,000, if you put the 68,000 over 25,000, you get a number of about 2.72, which is that for every student there's one employee for every 2.7 students, something like that. Is that a fair calculation?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll trust you on the math. I would just remind members that our 25,166 employees covers all three of our missions, and we're going to talk about some of the various types of jobs that are in those missions. But when you take that employee base, that's including all of our scientists, all of our researchers, all of our extension educators, all of our clinical folks, all of our food service workers, so on and so forth. So then I hope this study gives you a little context into that ratio.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, do you have, at some point, could you provide us comparative information with other institutions about that kind of ratio? And obviously, you know, it'd have to be, you know, land-grant universities, mm-hmm. I would presume, have similar missions.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're going to take you through some comparative data here, but we can also certainly give you at a total employee at research universities compared just to their student headcount. Yes, we can. That's a reportable figure that we can get for you.
And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, and can you break that down into faculty and non-faculty positions as well?
Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll look at the available data, but I believe the answer will be yes.
Thank you.
And spare the trees. Let's just get the information.
Yes, sir.
I don't know who to direct this to, but you already alluded to the fact that President Kaler, when he came in, had a concern about administration, and he expressed it, and you initiated this process. So there was a concern, and my concern is I had a regent in my office yesterday, one that wasn't running for re-election, and I had a regent in my office today, and that person was not running for re-election. This, by the way, is the first to have two regents in two consecutive days who are not running for election in my office. I just say that to add to, I hope, the credibility of what I'm about to continue with. And they both say that this process is going to ultimately answer a lot of questions because you will have a benchmark to work forward from. My concern is, President Kaler came in and he initiated this, and from your previous testimony, it's apparent that the university is driven by the president. So once you put this in place, can a future president come in and just say, no, we're going to ignore the benchmarking and we're going to go on a back to the old creaky, what did you call it, creaky and it's creaky administrative analysis? Mr. Fitzenreiter?
Mr. Chairman, when I said creaky, I was referencing the creakiness of a very old and archaic HR process and system of how they classified employees in higher ed.
Which is expressed in slide 48, but you're going to get down there, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So can another president come in and just ignore all this and then we're back to where we were?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know, as many of the regents have pointed out along the way who are running, there is a governing board for the university, the Board of Regents, and one would expect that because they hire the president, that the accountability and desires of the Board of Regents in that area wouldn't just be up to the president to say, well, we're just not going to care about this anymore. Presidents come with different priorities. It will be really between the board and the president as to how this happens in the future. This president is definitely interested and concerned about this topic, and that's what's driven us to provide him with information.
Mr. Fitzenrider, and I appreciate that, and I hope the members do too. When we have the joint convention of the two higher ed committees, and then we have the House and Senate, I would hope you would ask questions of those region candidates that they're going to continue this process regardless of who the president of the university is, and that this is going to be an ongoing evaluation of the university, and not just its administration, but exactly how the university takes the funds that they get, tuition or state, and how they spend them. Just as a reminder to the committee, there are questions that we should ask of these candidates. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll just turn to my colleague and we'll continue on here, and I'm sure you're going to have questions.
Mr. Chairman, members, before we get into our benchmarking study, I'm going to take you through just two slides around the iPads data, which is data that we report to the federal government, all institutions of higher education do.
And Mr. Carlson, explain what that is.
Yes, that's the, where is it here, Jill? The Institutional Post-Secondary Education Data System, which is required by the federal government for any school that receives federal money of any types. So not just sponsored money, but federal student aid. And we report in several categories, finance, HR, number of students, number of degrees, so on and so forth. And one of the things we report in the in our HR categories is our employee base in a number of categories defined by iPads. And the one in front of you is a slide that shows our count and some other schools' counts of a category labeled executive, administrative, and managerial. And I will tell you that the University of Minnesota in this category among higher ed research institutions is number one. And that's not a good place, a good category to be number one in. But I do want to put it in some context, and so I've grabbed some other schools here for you. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus is in the red box. And this is over the past 10 years. And you can see that from fall 2006 report to our fall 2007 report, we added 1,400 administrators to our count. I can assure the committee we did not actually bus in 1,400 additional administrators. There's data definition changes both in between 04 and 06. And you can see, for example, above the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, University of Michigan implemented that definitional change and went from 1,000 to 1,600. Some schools apparently decided that their count was consistent with that definitional change and decided not to change their counts. But let's just take a quick second and look at some of the other schools and what happens to them. Like, I don't believe we added 1,400 administrators. Let's start from the bottom, University of Wisconsin-Madison. I don't think they lost 800 administrators in 1 year, from 2002 to 2003. I don't think Washington-Seattle lost 500. Florida gained 200 this year. University of California, Berkeley, lost 500 and then rehired them. Or did something else. And I can't honestly tell you what's happening with our friends at Johns Hopkins. But I don't think that their administrative count bounces around quite that much. So I hope we take some of this data in context.
Well, Mr. Carlson, let's stay with Johns Hopkins for a second. They jumped up to 1509 and then went back to 741. And I look at the university, And for four consecutive years, you posted an outrageously high number and didn't catch it. So can you explain why this wasn't caught? I mean, obviously, you've had an incredible jump here. Didn't someone at the university say, we've had an incredible jump here and there's something wrong, and it happened for 4 years?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would say our data people believe they have been, in their minds, have interpreted the definitions correctly. But if I can turn to the next slide, I can show you some of the consequence on the other side of that. So this is another HR data category in the same IPEDS report called Other Professional Support Services. And you'll notice, again, same schools, same time period. University of Minnesota Twin Cities in the red box. In that same year, in that category, we dropped from 7,400 to 4,300 employees in that category. You also notice that a school like Washington, Seattle increased over 2,000. You can see the same sort of variability in Johns Hopkins that they've had. You can also see Michigan, Ann Arbor dropped, just like we did, as they interpreted those definitions differently. If you combine these two categories, members, the administrative managerial on the previous slide and this other professional support services on this slide, we, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, ranks 22nd of 72 in very high research institutions. We are below Wisconsin, Michigan, Washington. So I would contend that this, that combining, if you want to have a, from an IPEDS data, which we will, which we did not use in our study, we chose to benchmark it in a different way, but if you want to use IPEDS data, either combine these numbers or at least give us credit for the drop on the other side.
That doesn't explain, Mr. Coulson, though, why when President Kaler came in, he had a concern over administration, and I assume he wasn't looking at the chart on page or the 48 slide. He was looking at something else. And then the Wall Street Journal article hit and made a national splash about administration. So that's really where we have to get to, and that's where your benchmarking will ultimately tell us the validity of what is the administrative level at the university. That's where we need to be by the time we're done with these hearings.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we wanted to illustrate this IPEDS data both from the standpoint of just how difficult it is to compare across institutions with this data. It is hard. We see more value in benchmarking inside the university and then keeping track of that benchmark and where we move. But I want to, we also included it here and have shared it with other folks. This, that previous slide, that's the slide the Wall Street Journal reporter, that's why they wrote a story about us, was that first slide. That's what caught their attention. But I will tell you, we sat with that Wall Street Journal reporter and pointed this information and these mistakes out. He knew it, and he just chose to go with the story. We shared our benchmarking study with him. He admitted this data was bad, and that's just the price we paid, and you're exactly right, Mr. Chairman. We should have caught this and paid attention to it. That data reporting unit was reporting elsewhere in the organization upon the departure recently of one of the vice presidents. The position has been eliminated. That unit now reports to me, that now reports to Lincoln. So we are not going to allow the data to go out the way it's gone out in the past.
Mr. Fitzroy, that was my next question, and I'm glad we have two people now that we can go to if this reporting happens again, and we know someone at the university is watching it now. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Fitzenreiter, I'm not sure that correcting the data that's reported is really the issue. We're not talking about, we should be looking at the underlying facts and trying to make the data work rather than being first worried about sending out data that makes us look as good as possible.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you're absolutely right. I wasn't insinuating that we would manipulate the data. I want to get the data right.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, Mr. Carlson. You know, this iPads data is, I look at these two slides and it tells me nothing, because I don't believe that there were 93 administrators at Johns Hopkins in 2004. I mean, that's obviously nonsense. So it's not just the variability, but the sheer numbers are ridiculous on that slide 48. And slide 49, you know, that looks a bit more consistent at least. But if you, I mean, it points to the fact that everybody interprets this data however they want to, and some institutions probably interpret it in a way that makes sure that they're telling the best possible story. Mm-hmm. So I understand all the problems with that. But the advantage it does have is that you have all the universities doing the same thing, at least in theory. Your benchmarking internally doesn't have that advantage, does it?
Mr. Fitzner.
Mr. Chairman, no. I will tell you just one other thing about iPEDS. They've just recently changed the definitions again. So now in 3 years, 2 or 3 years,
2 years,
all this historical data that's been reported will be worthless, because when they change the definition, no one goes back in time and corrects the prior years. They don't do that. So now we're going to have another set of iPEDS data that isn't consistent over time.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, so you've convinced me that the iPEDS data isn't very helpful for comparative purposes, and you have a solution for internal purposes. Is there nothing out there nationwide that we can use for comparison purposes across universities?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we're not aware of any that would work. I think higher ed, I'll just say it, my opinion, I think higher ed needs to work harder across the country to get a shared understanding and a better national reporting of data. It's obvious to us that you can see the apparent flaws in how people are doing it. That's a national higher ed issue that higher ed needs to address.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, it would be nice if that were to happen, I suppose, because there's apparently no outside scrutiny that's going to help drive these expenses in the right direction. You know, if the measurements don't tell us anything and we don't have any other comparative points, we're all sort of flying blind. And so maybe the university could lead the charge in doing your benchmarking across the nation.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Members of the committee, on reporting this kind of stuff in iPEDS, I think I've just said it, it's bad. But we are engaging, and I digress here for a moment, we are engaging as part of a memo letter the president received from Senator Bonhoff to respond back to her on March 15th. One of the initiatives we're undertaking in response to her in that memo is a benchmarking study of our HR, IT, finance, and procurement functions. And there are consulting firms in the country who have a pretty deep database where we can benchmark our costs for those activities against Big Ten and private. So there is cost benchmarking, but the iPEDS data is just not good enough, in my opinion, to rely on.
Representative Winkler. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may get to this later, but I'm wondering if there's any correlation between the data divide lines that are created here and salary. Is there any correlation at all between salaries in these definitions?
Mr. Fitzenreiter and Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't believe I could make an immediate correlation. These are two of several HR divisions within iPEDS. I don't know that I wouldn't know what that correlation would look like.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I should clarify a little bit here, but so you pointed out that cumulatively between the two iPEDS slides that the totals for those positions are the same, and I'm wondering when the definition changed, is there any relationship to salaries in those various categories, and what is that relationship if there is one?
Mr. Coles.
Mr. Chairman, members, no, that there would be no correlation between the definitional changes and salaries. I can give you an example. So one of the reasons our number topped there is we, as our people interpreted the definition, we included a job code called coordinators. We'll talk about coordinators a little bit. 774 of them. These coordinators have, it's a non-descriptive job code. Those coordinators can be coordinating administrative processes in Morrill Hall. They could be coordinating educational programs out in Crookston. They could be coordinating research program in Austin. Very wide ranging.
Representative Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going off what Representative Winkler was talking about, it seems we have a situation where we deem a need for what iPads should be doing, but we aren't at all getting that. Where is the governance or oversight or management of iPads? Who are the right people we need to correct this situation with? Because I don't think just saying it's messed up, we can't look at it, is a solution. Thank you.
Mr. Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. So this is the U.S. Department of Education, but I can give you, we'll see. Let's take it as hopeful. So when Vice President Fitzroyer said they are changing the definitions, they are. They are going to something called the Standard Occupational Classifications. This is the U.S. Bureau of Labor Services definitions, which should be more standard, not only hopefully within higher education, but also across industries. So these are classifications that other industries use for various reporting. We've spent the last several months, because we have to report this spring in those new classifications. We've spent the last several months looking at all of our 25,000 employees, all of our 600 some job codes, and various listservs with other Big Ten colleagues to try to get those, not only our people in the right categories on a definitional basis, but try to have at least some comparability, at least among our Big Ten colleagues. We've also started that process, quite frankly, on the financial side. We're working with our colleagues at the University of Iowa and in the future other Big Ten universities around the financial classifications of expenditures that that we need to report on that side as well. So we feel like we need both internal consistency and some way to compare ourselves with like universities. It's, in my opinion, unsustainable to be able to keep sitting here and saying we can't define these things. We have to be able to define these things. But if they're going to change definitions on us on a regular basis, we are also going to have to engage in an internal benchmarking study like we did so that we can have at least an internal, consistent trend line that we can manage to.
Representative Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just close with then saying that if in the future you see things that iPeds is doing that doesn't seem to be auditing correctly or doesn't seem to be accurately reflecting, that be brought more quickly to the legislature, and so hopefully we can assist in correcting those so we get what we need to see. So thank you.
Representative Grunhagen, do you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, to the testifiers, I've gotten a couple of emails. One of them was from a U of M Alumni Association Life member, and he brings out some interesting facts in regards to tuition at the University of Minnesota. He covers a time period of 2002 to 2012 where the U of M budget went from $2 billion to $2.948 billion. Okay? And in there, he brings out that during that same period of time, state sponsorship or subsidy of the university declined from $643 million down to $572 million, so about a 10 to 15% decrease. Yet during that same period of time, as far as tuition and fees, after scholarships and grants from 2002 to 2012, the total tuition went from $293 million to over $696 million. So it more than doubled over that period of time, yet state subsidy declined by only 10 to 15%. Now, if you look at those two, now he has a lot of other things in here too, but he's got links and documentation on there. But when you look at those figures and then you look at the corrupted data of iPads, it appears that the tuition funded more administration. But that's obviously can't be a right conclusion. But, you know, why would tuition need to more than double over that period of time when state funding declined by only 10 to 15% over that same 2002-2012 period of time?
Mr. Fitzenreiter?
Mr. Chairman, we did discuss that a couple of meetings ago, so we could, but I mean, as I testified at the time, tuition has gone up to invest more money and programs for students. It's gone up to address increasing costs at the institution. It's gone up because state funds have gone down. It has gone up because enrollment is up. The credit hours taken are up. That all those factors have driven the tuition number that is referenced there. I presume the individual is taking from our, I think, our annual financial statements, because some of the numbers are familiar. I wouldn't dispute his numbers, and we've talked about why the tuition revenue has gone up. The overall budget of the institution has, in fact, grown considerably over that time period as a result of increases in tuition, but also in sponsored research, in parking rates and housing rates, in sales and service activities and ICR recoveries. A whole host of revenues have grown.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, and just a couple follow-up comments here. He goes on to state that displacing the agricultural research at the U of M, you said you added more programs and things, but yet he seems to be very concerned that the agricultural research at the Umore Park has produced hundreds of millions of dollars for the state economy, and yet that's been displaced in the university's overall expenditures. Would you like to comment on that?
Familiar enough about how he's referencing anything at Umore Park. As I think the committee knows, Umore Park is our parcel of land down in Rosemont. We have initiated recently a contract to mine important gravel on that site. There is research activity, agricultural research activity, that occurs on that land. At some point, the gentleman is correct. If he's referencing that research activity on that land down there as a result of the gravel mining will be displaced and moved have to be moved to another location. That is quite a distance in the future. It is not imminent, but the gentleman is correct that will be the research on those acres. I don't recall how many acres are actually under research down there, but it will be inevitably moved. Not done away with, but moved.
Representative Grunigan.
Yeah, just, and the other areas that he had concern about is the crumbling academic facilities. It seems like, regardless of how much money that has been spent, the facilities are deteriorating in many of the, you know, in many of the areas of the university. He has a link on that.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, we'll be getting to capital, but that's okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, university's primary source, we'll talk about this more in a minute, primary source of capital is from the state of Minnesota. We do issue our own bonds to improve facilities as well as coming to the state of Minnesota. I'm not sure what particular document he's referencing that it's crumbling. I would not describe it that way. But we have information for the committee members if they'd like to see. We do a financial condition assessment, a facility condition assessment where we track deferred maintenance, and that's something we shared with the Capital Investment Committee several times in the last couple of biennium, and we'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
Representative Grunhagen, one more?
One more, yeah. as long as I get the floor, with your permission. The other areas that he hits on is the spending hundreds of millions of dollars on the administration part, but I'll leave that alone. We've been discussing that to a certain degree. The other email I got, though, was from a discouraged parent whose son had applied to the university here in Minnesota, resident, and had a 3.7 GPA and had been declined, and their concern was that the that more and more the university seems to be having a goal of attracting more and more out-of-state and foreign students to the detriment of Minnesota resident students. And he goes on to provide quite a bit of documentation on that. But would you, I brought this up in the past, but is there a balance between Minnesota's benefiting from Minnesota taxpayer dollars versus foreign and out-of-state students benefiting from those Minnesota tax dollars to a bigger extent than what Minnesota students do?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I recall the percentage correctly, I think system-wide Minnesota residents make up 73% of the enrollment at the University of Minnesota. And that's been a very consistent number for quite a long time. So there is not a move to replace or lower that percentage of Minnesota residents attending the University of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Representative Swedinski.
Mr. Chair, my question would be, kind of you touched on a little bit the Rosemont facility, how you're going to kind of change its goal, opening up for gravel mining and some of that. Probably really kind of that opened up, and I had been doing a little bit of reading, just looking at the university and land, and kind of just in general, I think it's maybe 50,000 acres that you guys roughly are in control of. Some of the other reading I looked at was about 30,000 acres of potential mining rights that you guys own as a university. And wanted to really, we kind of looked at that with school trust lands last session through K-12, and just wanted to visit with you a little bit. Maybe this might not be the time to do that, but just looking for information in general on, you know, the revenues that are generated through state lands, the through the university, the mining rights, and how those things are being explored, how that process goes for if you've, you know, delegated some of that to the DNR or whatever, as far as you know, that process goes, and then how those funds are then utilized within the university. You know, being a land grant university, that's kind of what that's for, and I think that's an important key. And obviously, I missed last time, and maybe you guys went through that as well then, but would like to explore that.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be I'd be happy to come by. It is a complicated issue. The state actually directs how the university, we do receive royalty payments. We have mineral rights on what's called puff lands. The university receives royalties off of that. The legislature defines in statute how those dollars are spent. It goes to a scholarship account. It goes now to a mining program in northern Minnesota. Former Representative Rukavina had a particular interest in this, but we could come by and show you the whole fund flow, the money. But it is controlled in statute by you folks.
Thank you.
Mr. Fitzgerald, I'm going to return to this for a second. Within the last 18 months, you've had a rather remarkable thing happen at the university. You had a president come on board and have a concern about administration. You then had a Wall Street Journal article which made it national. Whether their numbers are accurate or not, it certainly brought to light a problem with heavy administration inside higher education. Thirdly, you had the leader of the Senate and the Senate chair of higher education submit a letter to you, which the governor then took to heart and said, I'm going to withhold the university's budget request until there is a definitive answer on this administrative issue. Now, you're going to give us that answer in March. If the answer is that the university is heavy in administration, what will happen?
The president has committed to reduce administrative costs at the institution, and we will continue to march down that path of reducing costs. That's the president's commitment. He's made it to the university community, and that's what we're focused on, and that's what we're working on. I would take some issue here that the Wall Street Journal has decided that the University of Minnesota has administrative bloat. Now, I would argue that point, and I think we'll get a chance to point that out as we go along. I would not rely on comments from a Wall Street Journal reporter to define administrative bloat, one in which he's defining that bloat based on a misinterpretation of IPED's data.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, I thought I had qualified my statement to say it illustrated a perception that there was administrative bloat. But the president of the university has the same perception. There have been discussions inside the legislature for years on administration in higher education. You have a governor now that for the first time in my memory has said, I'm going to withhold part of a budget request based on whether or not you can answer the question, are you going to do something about administrative costs at you? And what is the problem with this? I know you're benchmarking. So I'm trying, and I know it might be premature, but March isn't that far away. Once the report comes in, and it does say that you've got too much administration, your answer then is there will be a reduction in administration at the university.
Mr. Chairman, we're reducing administrative costs now. One important part of that report, a study work with a consultant we've already begun as a result of that, what will be in that report is a spans and layers analysis. So how many people report to how many people at the university, and is it the right mix of span of control? Do we have too many people with a director title that have two reports when maybe they should have five or six reports in their span of control? That's part of a spans and layers analysis that we're doing with a consultant. That studies and work's been launched. That'll be part of the March 15th report. And based on that, I will tell you that between the time receiving that letter in March 15th, after March 15th, there will be more work to do. We will get a baseline set of data and a better understanding, and then we will proceed with further work in that area. That's the commitment the president's making.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, I'm hopeful that once the university is done with its analysis of administration, in case there's any other group in the room that might also have been criticized for administration in Minnesota, excessive administration, maybe just a few blocks away in downtown St. Paul, that they may be thinking about doing a similar report. That's just an FYI, in case there's anyone else in the room that's doing a report after the university's done. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just had a question about the spans and layers. Is that something that is for just administrative purposes or managers, or would that be within every kind of responsibility so that, you know, there's a great push, I know, in healthcare and other areas that people are being encouraged to work up to their fullest ability or potential of scope of duty, and is that would that be done on all levels?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this spans and layers will focus on the administrative spans and layers at this time. Between now and again, March 15th, we focus this in discussions with Senator Bonoff on the administrative part of this, so it's less about how many people report to a faculty member on a research grant. It's focused on the administrative functions at the institution and whether the spans and layers are appropriately benchmarked. And we will be doing this with a national human resource consulting firm and be able to benchmark this against other institutions and the private sector.
Representative Pop?
That's all.
All right, let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm just going to take you through a framework of this benchmarking study that we put together. We did base it on the both the workforce analysis and the mission cost of mission study that we did. But what we did is we wanted to take all of the costs of the university, all the expenditures, both personnel and non-personnel, and put them into, we decided conceptually, really three buckets. People and expenses related to the direct mission delivery, the doers of the mission, instruction, research, and public service. The people and related expenditures that support the mission and the facilities of the of our campuses. And a category called administrative oversight, those expenses related to the leadership, direction, control, and management of the institution. So we have put all of our personnel, again, one of the things I don't like about taking slices of any data is I like to see all the data and then put it somewhere so we all know where it went. So we took all of our employees, all 667 job codes, and assigned them to one of those three buckets, and we'll take you through those to give you a sense of what they were. And we took all of our non-personnel expenses, our supplies, our equipment, so on and so forth, and by function code, proportioned those costs into direct mission activities, mission support activities, or administrative oversight. And so let me take you through a little bit of that before we get to the results, just to give you a flavor. So direct mission delivery, 57% of our personnel spend, 50% of our overall spend once you include non-personnel expenses. And the bullets there give you a sense of the types of employees, job codes that are in those categories. So obviously our professors would be in there, but also all of our adjunct instruction, extension educators. We have obviously a large health science operation at the university. Those professionals are in there. We have people labeled scientists and laboratory technicians, full-time researchers that are running our labs. Our student employees, our graduate assistants, teaching assistants, research assistants are in here. And then all our non-personnel expenses coded as instruction, research, or public service by their function code. So that's how we assign direct mission delivery. In the mission support areas, a couple different takes. We put all of the support codes that we deemed as non-supervisory in nature. So these are the people, the accountants and the infotech folks fixing the computers for faculty and so on and so forth. All the clerical support is in here. A lot of what we called other specialized support for this category, but we, you know, the University of Minnesota is an interesting place at how wide-ranging it is. So we have curators and librarians and advisors and athletic coaches. We have a captain. We have a job code called captain and a job code called chief mate because we have a research vessel in Lake Superior, and that's we hire in those categories. And we have a prorated share of supplies and services and equipment for those categories as well. We also put all the facility support here. Again, the non-supervisory folks. So these are the buildings and ground workers, the engineers, our safety technicians, and all of the utilities, repairs, and maintenance related to those facilities. And our final category, which we've been zeroing in on here, administrative oversight. So 11% of the total personnel spend in these categories, 9% of the overall spend. These are really the leadership and management job codes and related expenses. So here we've put the executive leadership of the institution, the president, the vice presidents, the chancellors, the academic leadership of the institution, our deans and associate deans and department chairs, our directors. There's another problematic job code for us, just like the coordinators. We have a job. We have job codes. This is director, associate director, that is not necessarily reflective of or descriptive of what they actually do. So we could have directors in finance areas. We could have directors in extension. We could have directors in directing research programs.
Mr. Coulson, Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you finished describing these different aspects, I would like to see, as Representative Grunhagen has said in the past, some historical data. Could you show me how this has changed over the last 10 years? For example, mission and support facilities, have those numbers remained the same in terms of how many people are working and so forth, so I have some perspective on the of the data.
Mr. Coulson.
Mr. Chairman, members, at the last slide here, we will give you the comparative data between 2006 and 2012 as requested by the chair on administrative oversight. I will tell you that as part of the workforce analysis, we did that 10-year, 11-year graph. We did break that down into subcategories, and we could attempt to answer some of the questions later off of some of that data. I believe the members would be might be surprised that actually the percent spend over time in various categories, take it academic or facilities or so forth, stays pretty stable. You know, within a percent or two of the total 100% over the 10-year period that we analyzed.
Mr. Chair, I would like to see particularly the mission support and facilities numbers. Thank you.
Mr. Coulson.
Just for a little context, additional context on the administrative oversight area, this is how those costs broke down in the personnel categories. So of that administrative oversight category, around 20% is institutional executive leadership and academic leadership. About 40% is in those director categories, and you can see there in the pie chart where those directors land. And then we have other supervisors and managers throughout the organization, so just some illustrative examples. So those would include nurse managers and infotech supervisors, library supervisors, food operations managers, so on and so forth. So slide 55 is the result for FY12 of all of that categorization, attempting to put the full $3.059 billion FY12 expenditures into those buckets. And at the very bottom, line 24 there, that is where we are showing 50% of our expense in mission, 9% in student aid, 32% in mission support and facilities, and 9% in administrative oversight. For a personnel only number, you can look at line 13. Final slide then that we have is the comparison between 2006 and 2012 as requested. So we ran the same data back for that year, administrative oversight. Personnel spend as a percent of total expense from 10% to 11%. The headcount growth, some of that is in just in growth and employment during this time period. Remember, undergraduate enrollment went up 8.3%, degrees went up 17%, sponsored research went up 44%. I'm sure we've added some supervisors in there. There is some job family reclassification that goes on, especially in our IT and finance area. So, for example, in 2006, we didn't have a job category called finance manager or finance director. They were often be coordinators or associate twos or some nondescriptive job category. We have made that change in a couple of those areas so that we can better understand our workforce. I wouldn't consider those new employees, but about 180 of those, of that 261 increase, can be seen in those two areas for job family increases. We were also asked to provide the top 41 administrative oversight salaries for 2013. That's been delivered to the committee. We just note that our total salary base for those positions versus our peer medians is 8% below, and we have provided information and attachments on our administrative oversight salaries. The 1731 employees lined up high to low, those top 41 base pay and 2012 bonus payments as required by contract terms.
Mr. Fitzreiner, let's stay on 56 for a second. So during this period of cuts, tuition increases, and what we're now going to get a report on debt, administration did go up at the university.
Mr. Chairman, as a percent of our budget, it moved from 10% to 11% as we've defined it here.
Yes. And is this how the benchmarking is going to define it?
It's one of many. We'll define it by category. We'll define it total. We're going to track several data points out of this information. We'll track it by fund source. As my colleague mentioned, between this period alone, our grants, federal research, business and industry, based on how we've defined the administrative code here by a supervisor or manager, if we take on another, I mean, we get NIH research grant, and the grant terms of accepting the grant will require us to add a coordinator or a manager, program manager for that grant. That's going to show up here in the headcount and show up in the spending. We're going to track it in a variety of ways.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, the report that's due in March, slides 50 through 56, is this the data that the entity that's going to do the analysis, is this the core of the data they're going to be looking at?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as I mentioned, there's two major exercises underway in response to the March 15th. It's the spans and layers. So in the spans and layers, they'll be going in and actually looking not just at the administrative oversight column on here, but they're going to also be looking at the support column on this sheet, because we're interested in looking at the spans and layers for all the activities outside of the academic mission. So they'll be looking at all of it, not just the narrow one here, but the focus is clearly of interest is on the administrative side. On the benchmarking exercise that we'll undertake, that's actually benchmarking particular activities. It's not just that isn't looking at the number of folks in this activity. They're going to go in and cost what it takes to what do we spend in procurement? What does it cost us to purchase X, Y, and Z compared to a benchmark? What does it cost us? We've actually already done a lot of work in that area, but we're going to have them come in and benchmark us against our peers and see where we stack up. Those are the two main drivers of what we're going to do in the and report in the March 15th letter, as well as all the other activities that we have underway that we think address and clarify our administrative costs.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, your report in March comes out. Governor Dayton looks at it, and we look at it, and we're not satisfied. And the decision is made to withhold the university's budget request until we are satisfied. I don't want you to answer this question in specificity now, but I'm going to ask it later. What would the consequences be? I don't want an answer now, but I would like to know the consequences if the university's budget request is withheld.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make sure that the president understands that question.
I asked it to him already, but I just wanted to make sure you had it. All right. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know which of the testifiers would respond, but I think these categories make a great deal of sense: mission delivery, mission support, and administrative oversight. Can you provide us with breakdown information for each category? On slide 51, you've got bulleted categories of employees. Can you provide us both a breakdown of total employees under each of these categories, as well as the longitudinal changes from 2006 to 2012?
Mr. Fitzreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes.
Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, members, yeah, the answer is yes. I just want to caution members that this is a spend analysis versus a headcount analysis. So as those numbers are provided, we do both because the headcount is descriptive, but we like the spend analysis primarily because it allows for split appointments. So if you have a half-time associate dean that's also a professor, this allows that. When we're doing a headcount analysis, we force people into a primary job code.
You don't do half ahead?
We don't do half ahead because we have. If it was only half ahead, if that was the only our biggest issue there, we'd do it. But we have summer appointments. We have so on and so forth. So I just caution members as you see that data, you got to understand that they're two slightly different sets of information.
Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, and Mr. Fitzenreiter, your comparison on page 56, I think, is, you know, it's relatively high level, but it'd be interesting to see a similar slide for direct mission delivery and mission support facilities as well. And then, again, a breakdown of each of those bulleted points on slides 51, 52, and 53 to see what the total allocations are and how that changes over time.
And Mr. Carlson or Mr. Fitzgerald, if you provide that, provide enough copies for everyone in the committee also so we can all take a look at it simultaneously. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be more of a comment than a question, but I know you had said the percentage of spending on administration is virtually the same throughout this six-year period. Now, also in light of what Representative Grunhagen had said about the total budget increasing by nearly half in the last 10 years, it may be more effective for me to understand the actual numbers of the increased in administrative costs. So that I think would, for me personally, be helpful to really get a full grasp of where these numbers are and where the money's going.
Mr. Fitzen,
well, all right. See what we can do for you, Mr. Chairman.
Another question. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, you've stated a number of times that the one of the drivers of tuition increases has been rising costs. According to your slide 56, you would suggest that administrative expenses have not been driving those rising costs. What are the big cost drivers?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, big cost drivers at the Institute, at the University of Minnesota, clearly, oddly enough, new buildings, very expensive. Research buildings are extremely expensive. That's a cost driver. Fringe rates, particularly health care, compensation, we're a people business. Technology has been a big cost driver. And the demand for that technology. Student aid, big cost driver. We put a lot of money into financial aid at the institution through the Promise Scholarship that was started by President Brunix. That's probably the big ones.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, I wonder if you could talk just a bit about why student aid is a cost driver. I mean, it's a curious system where one of the things that you use to offset rising costs creates the need for higher costs.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when I was describing the student aid or a cost driver, I'm simply pointing out that when you go back in time and you look at where we've spent increasing money, financial aid is one of those places where we're spending more money. And I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but you know, we have carved out of the budget. Some might argue that it's financial aid. We're increasing. Some argue we're increasing. I'm going to get really in trouble. That we're increasing tuition, and then using that tuition to buy down tuition for other students in the face of declining state money, in the face of what's happened to the state grant program, We have carved that money out of our budget and reallocated funds and raised revenue. I mean, remember, when we talk about our budget framework, we're talking about the entire budget challenge and what levers we have to address that. Student aid, we have become, frankly, more like a private institution in that regard, to try to keep college affordable for low-income and middle-income students at the university.
Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, this is another request, and maybe I don't recall seeing this. Is it possible to break down the amount, the percentage of your total budget that is derived from student loans?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
I believe the answer to that question is yes, and I think an earlier slide we pointed out how much student loans that was just undergraduate numbers. But yeah, you can interpret that as that those student loans are paying the cost of attendance. They're not all paying tuition. But let us noodle on that some, Mr. Chairman, and get back to you.
And Mr. Fitzenreiter,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, the expression I have heard from someone outside this room was that the university was farming the financial aid system in order to offset unsteady state appropriations. And I thought that was an interesting verb, you know, for a land-grant university. but if you're, which, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. If there's a system for the federal government to provide aid and subsidize student loans, and students are willing to take on debt in order to pursue a degree, that's a revenue source for the university. What do you call it? Your solution. But that's a revenue source. So I'd be curious to know how much of your total budget just comes from students having to borrow money in order to attend. And I think cost of attendance is a reasonable measure.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Yes, and as I said that day, that made it into several newspapers. You know, all of those dynamics are at play in higher ed. You know, I can speak to it personally when my two sons were attending the University of Minnesota, and you go to fill out the, for one of them who attended law school, you fill out the FAFSA, you borrowed money. You've got to actually, the student actually has to check a box to make sure you don't take all the money they're offering. So it's pretty easy just to take what the federal government's offering. You got to take another action to not take it. So it's kind of a funny, peculiar way to run the federal program, in my opinion.
If you looked at my household budget, Mr. Chair, yep, Mr. Fitzenreiter, if you looked at my household budget, you wouldn't think it was so funny.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and kind of along the lines of Representative Winkler, but you did talk about a new program that has been developed for aid for students, and I guess I would just like to know, again, I think it's along the same lines, but the cost and benefit of that, because we have students who are, certainly you're opening doors for more students potentially to get financial aid resources in order to attend the university, and again, I'd just like to know, did that change the number of students that were given greater access and greater than affordability toward going to college, and the benefit of that, if that makes sense?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Well, our enrollment, Mr. Chairman, members, our enrollment has stayed, has grown some over time. I'd have to think about your question a little more, and we could talk about it offline. I'm just not quite sure how to answer specifically.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, again, just thinking that if you're creating a program for student aid to be able to then provide students to buy down the cost of the institution, so there must be some cost to benefit ratio that you've determined. There was a reason for creating the program, and maybe that's the kind of the bottom line. What was the reason for creating the program? What was the outcome you expected, and have you met the outcome that you're anticipating or expecting?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I wouldn't have the data in front of me at the moment, but for example, our Promise program certainly was not only in response to our lowest income families, but we've extended, deliberately extended to middle income families where we felt that certainly federal, the state does a pretty good job actually with state grant program on middle income, but the federal income money drops off pretty precipitously for middle income students. So we have extended our institutional aid programs to try to address that. And as we talked about last time, you know, that's resulted in net price for not only low income but middle income families that's lower than a lot of other institutions in the state.
Representative Dorholt.
Before we move into the next portion of the slides, just kind of learned a few things from the auditor this morning, and I was wondering what else might we see from what you've presented us so far had the U been subject to review by the state auditor, and things you think should be included, and might we see some of that information come March? This is kind of it's a bigger, broader one, but I'm pretty curious as to, as we dig into the details. And I know you may feel as you are being subject to a auditorial review for this committee, but those are the things I think we're going to want to see. Well, that's kind of my question to all three of you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bitzenrider.
So if I'm understanding the correct question right, Mr. Chairman, you are asking me what I think the state auditor ought to. Mm-hmm. Maybe you got to say it again. I might have missed it.
Representative Dorholt.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you're familiar with being subject to auditing by the state auditor through past experiences. If the university was subject to such an audit, what might we see that you haven't presented? And might that stuff come forward in the future? I'm sure you're familiar with the binder on Chairman Plowski's desk from Perpich's higher ed budget, seeing those numbers, dollars for dollars, cents for cents, where they go and how they're spent. I know it'd be a massive operation, but sometimes we tend to overgeneralize those numbers in a PowerPoint presentation. So I'm just wondering, from what's been brought to us up until now, what else could we see in the future that would be relevant to an audit, an actual full-on audit? I know it's a big question, but it's been hindering me for a long time.
Mr. Pitzer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I guess I would really like to think about some more questions, some more, come and chat with you about it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if we can move to the next section of the discussion. This is on just a background and answer some questions from the chairman on capital financing and the capital budget process. By board policy, Board of Regents policy, the institution does two things here for the board. We do a six-year capital plan that identifies eligible projects that identifies eligible projects in that six-year capital plan. We bring that six-year capital plan back to the Board of Regents annually. It is a six-year plan that includes a forward look of what would we be bringing in the legislative request? What projects are we planning to do on our own? It would include academic projects. It includes housing projects, parking facilities, repairs and replacements, money we get from or thinking of applying to the federal government for. It is a six-year capital plan that's guided by, in part, and I'll talk about this shortly, the university's own debt capacity, as well as our needs that we would be coming in the future to the state. We also then bring to the board annually a capital budget, and the annual capital budget represents a list of projects in which we actually have the money in a financial plan to construct. if we go to the next slide, the university does issue its own long-term debt. As of 6/30/2012, in the little red box there, well, we have $1.2 billion of university bonds and commercial paper outstanding. We monitor that really in two buckets. $913.5 million of that is supported by the institution as a whole, and thanks to both the TCF Bank Stadium appropriation in which we issued that debt, as well as the Biomedical Facilities Authority. There is an additional roughly $307 million of bonds outstanding that is supported directly by those appropriations. We primarily issue fixed rate debt. We do have variable rate debt or commercial paper out. Jump down to the average, the state issued fixed rate debt there at 4.74%. That's really old bonds the state issued on our behalf back when the state was doing our one-third. However, today, when the legislature authorizes a capital project, we issue our one-third ourselves rather than have the state issue that debt. We do that because we often can bring the one-third to the table through fundraising, or we just simply have more flexibility in how we would approach financing that one-third. The weighted average cost of our capital right now is about 3.65%. I will tell you that this morning at approximately 10:30, we did an auction of $75 million in fixed rate debt for a variety of projects, including some of the one-third at the university that we're required to do. We did an auction, very first time we've done that. We used the system similar to what the state does when they auction their bonds, and we received a winning bid of 2.98% on a 25-year debt issue. So we were very pleased at that outcome. If you turn to the next page, we did get a question from the chairman about the growth in debt service. This particular number you see there under 2012, the total debt service of $105,796,000 was a correct number by the Wall Street Journal. I keep picking on him. Correct number by the Wall Street Journal. However, he had it for the wrong year. That was a 2012 figure, not a 2011 figure. That debt service has grown by $57.6 million, roughly 120% since 2002. And you can see underneath there the components of that increase. $10.2 million of it is the funding debt service that we get from the state that we turn around and pay the bonds on for the stadium. We have $1.4 million that comes from TCF Bank Stadium as part of that growth for the naming rights. You can see athletic stadium gifts and what athletics pays for their facilities. You can see the state paid biomedical bonds at roughly $7.8 million. Auxiliary debt, that's housing and parking, for example. You can see the student fee for the stadium and the rec center. We do, back in the ARRA bill, the stimulus bill, there was an opportunity that the federal government had to issue what were called Build America bonds. Those bonds were issued taxable, and then you receive a subsidy from the federal government. That's in the that's $2 million of the $57 million growth. And then the remaining roughly 25% is primarily O&M dollars. Not exclusively, but O&M dollars. And remember, in our system, O&M, when I say that term, is the state money and tuition combined. So I just wanted to point out to the committee that the bulk of the increase, almost 75% of the increase in our debt service since 2002, has been in areas other than the O&M state and tuition component of our budget. I see a question.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, I've wondered about this for some time. You've mentioned the TCF Stadium and other athletic facilities, and I have a baseline question, which is whether the athletic department is self-sustaining or whether it receives support from the rest of the university in terms of student fees, OM subsidies, et cetera, and if it's on its own, whether it is capable of paying the debt service on these facilities as well.
Yeah. Mr. Fitzenreiter or Mr. Tonneson, I don't know who wants to.
Mr. Chairman, we anticipated that question. And have a quick
It's an $800,000 question.
Yeah, we have a quick slide for you. See. If we can find it. It was in a backup slide. Better. We'll put that one up. And so, Mr. Chairman, members, we can also get this as a hard copy to you. This is the Twin Cities Athletics, and their budget allocation. Remember, we have a budget model, right? And they are treated as a unit just like an academic unit at the university. They received, when we went to this new system, they were receiving $9.5 million O&M allocation. That allocation has been reduced by $2.5 million over from 07 to 12, and the use of that current $7 million is in the box there. How do they do it? They pay for services, so in the $3.7 million, that's paying for their share of, remember we have cost pools, they pay their share of the technology costs at the institution, et cetera, in those cost pools. They pay $2.4 million of their own facility costs, and they support the McNamara Academic Center, which is the McNamara Academic Center is a center for the athletes. That's how they spend the $7 million, and they are treated just like everyone else, and their allocation has gone down, as I point out, by $2.5 million over this period. So their current support is $7 million.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, but as I understand what you just said, so they get $7 million in support, but they essentially pay that all back for their share of the services facilities of the McNamara Center.
That's correct.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, and what about debt service and the cost of supporting their capital needs?
That is paid for out of their regular budget, and some of it is paid here. So if we could share with, this is not the total athletics budget. We could certainly share that and what they spend their money on. This is just the what we would call the central allocation part of their budget.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter. So just so I'm totally clear, I don't need to see the athletic department's expenditures. But what I'm wondering about is if there is any other support provided by the O&M function. You know, I
Mr.
guess
Chairman,
category of funding.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is no.
And
Representative Wickler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, and so the TCF bonds and any other athletic department bonds, they're all paid for out of athletic department funds.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, if we did see the athletic budget, how big is the Big Ten TV portion of this subsidy?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that right off the top of my head. We can get it for you.
All right. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Fitzenreiter, my colleague, Representative Rosenthal, reminded me that there is a student fee that pays in part for the McNamara. I'm not sorry for McNamara, but for TCF.
Mr. Chairman, there is it's $12.50 student fee per semester that supports debt service on the TCF Bank Stadium, and that was done by President Brunix at the time the stadium was constructed. That's correct.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, are there any other sources of money from any source other than internal to the athletic department that go to support athletic department programs?
I don't believe facilities. So, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, next slide. This is the current amortization schedule structure in our debt. You can see the university debt there, the state supported. We break that out separate. We talked about that. That is the stadium and the biomed bonds. And then there's the Gateway Corporation. That's the McNamara Center. That's a separate legal entity. an affiliated organization of the university. However, the reason we track it and count it in our debt capacity is because, frankly, even though it's a separate legal entity, it's that Gateway Corporation is made up of the Alumni Association and the foundation. They actually impact our credit when they issued that debt. When the rating agencies look at the University of Minnesota, this is a pie chart as to how they view us and view public institutions. They do take a look at the level of state support, student demand, strength of management, and they look at a variety of financial ratios, but three in particular that I'm going to share with you in a moment is what we focus on, much like the state focuses on certain elements to determine debt capacity and our credit worthiness. They look at these three in particular, and I'm going to share that with you in a moment. We are, with Moody's Investors Services, we are one notch below a AAA and just two notches in the Standard & Poor's rating. We received, because we issued
debt. Sorry, we have a question. Representative Poppy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's related to slide 61. Just with regards to the amortization, could you break that down into if it's Twin Cities campus, if it's Duluth, Morris, Crookston, other campuses and other sites, stations or institutes?
Mr. Chairman, members, we have amortization schedules on every bit of the debt we've issued. I'll go back and we should be able to break that down by the payers of that debt, yes. This is the institution as a whole. Mm-hmm. To the extent that the institution's issued debt on behalf of a project at Duluth, mm-hmm. There's an amortization schedule around that mm-hmm. project. Mr. Chairman, when we do a six-year capital plan, we do a projection of those three key ratios. One of those ratios is total resources to direct debt. I'm going to go through these fairly quickly, but the desired trend on this ratio by the rating agencies is, of course, up. Now, I would point out that this, the next three ratios I'm going to show you are trending up because the model itself that we use is paying off debt. So this amortization schedule pays off the debt relatively quickly. You can see that we pay off almost $50 million of debt each and every year. But we're going to issue debt again, so we're monitoring our financial ratios at the same time we're deciding then how much debt capacity the university has. We do these three key ratios. The next one is expendable resources to modify direct debt. I won't go into the details of how those are calculated. They're at the bottom of the page. The one that perhaps you're most familiar with is, or the simplest perhaps to understand, is debt service to operations. So this is taking the $106 million of debt service. What percentage of our budget is, of our total expenditures, is devoted to that? And you can see that the Moody's median here is not to be above 3.1%. They do have a range. I mean, you could go above or below a range here and not necessarily have your debt rating influenced, but we try to stay right around the median on this one. We will, because we haven't, of course, issued any more debt, trending low, but this is one that prior to when the state had a debt service to net non-dedicated revenues back in the day, they've changed their debt capacity and debt ratios. This was one that was similar to that measure.
Mr. Fitzgerald, I'm going to stop you here, and we'll pick up approximately slide 67, and if we finish on Monday, we will then bring Minsky up. Members, slide 67 and onward is another request that the chair made weeks before, and I would hope you'd take a look at that last section. Representative Dorholt, do you have a motion?
I move that the minutes from February 4th be approved.
Representative Dorholt moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.